Your profession is standing the test of time, and it's literally in front of all of us here. What hasn't changed from the Empire State Building to J.P. Morgan? Or maybe I should ask, what has changed?
We're an industry that really straddles this line between like data and metrics and feeling.
We're artists. We craft things.
There's 50 different ways of doing it. We're not only just designers, but we're educators. Let the person rise, because the new generation, they're not as patient as we were.
We are in an industry that is trendy because the architecture is trendy.
In the end, you become almost like an investigator, because you have to ask different questions to make sure that what they're telling you is really what they want.
On any given project, a lighting designer is a luxury good.
Yes, a building's going to last 150 years, right? That's great. But how many times has that been renovated?
We kind of live in a copycat world a little bit. So as soon as someone sees something as a good-looking project or a product that sells well or showed up in a magazine, we kind of quickly attach to it.
Mindsets have changed, that people just want these things like super fast.
And the incessant amount of meetings that others are requiring for us to prove that we're succeeding, we're at the edge of the cliff with that.
Before we jump in, I want to thank five companies that show up for this community: Gotham, Kelvix, LEDflex, Diode LED, and Targetti USA. Because this show exists thanks to their belief in designers and the work that they do every day. I'm really excited about this conversation, and I want to start where design actually begins: imagining what's possible. Every designer begins by imagining how a space should feel, calm, intimate, creating clarity or wonder. Yet lighting too often demands compromise. Performance versus flexibility, intent versus cost, good instead of better. Gotham starts with a different belief. Those decisions shouldn't carry the weight they usually do, because the right options are already built in. Their approach to architectural downlighting is designed around freedom. The freedom to explore, adapt, and refine without limitation. This is the new Gotham, where every option is already there. See it for yourself. Experience how Gotham's Ivo makes lighting design easier, faster, and more intuitive. Request a sample customized to your specs at gothamlighting.com/free samples. Now, I'm super excited to share this conversation with three brilliant minds in New York City. Let's get to it. Today is an opportunity to have a conversation, to share different perspectives on something you're all extremely passionate about, which is light and architectural lighting design. It goes to say, there's a city behind us that lives and breathes it all day. Where are we at? What is the state of this profession? What is the state of the curiosity, and what is the state of the opportunity?
One of the most amazing things to watch, you know, having been in the same firm for 25, 26 years now, is watching what the talent is that's coming in and seeing how they're making their mark within the industry, you know, and allowing them to do that is huge. We bring in people with the intent that, you know, they are the best that is out there, and they're going to be able to contribute something to it. And I'm excited about seeing what they bring to the table, right? Because we have our ideas, right? Firms that have been established for decades. You know, we have our own practice. We have our understanding of what we do. But the ability for us to shift that mindset a little bit with the individuals who are coming in next in line, if you will, to help influence what we do, I find that just fascinating.
I mean, I agree 100%. I mean, the idea that you see these new ideas, I mean, we're always looking for taking inspiration. And what can we do to be excited? And I think new talent, new ideas, new projects, just that general excitement, I think, allows us to kind of grow and to kind of see it consistently. And through new talent and design trends and stuff like that, I think all those things inspired me to keep designing and start a starting something new and trying to figure it out, because a lot of times we start down a path and have no idea where we're going to end up at some point, you know?
Yeah, I would say learning from that new talent, because also they have techniques that when we went to school, it's like, I will say, you know, I was still drafting by hand or doing just AutoCAD, but a rendering, you know, barely knew Photoshop, whereas now they have all these software available to them. And see, they teach us also to push the envelope, to try new things that get us out of our comfort zone, but also to keep up with the rest of the industry. But I'll piggyback on what both of you said, but also I think sometimes it's nice to potentially find, when I say new clients, like different design teams, like different architects, different interior designer, because when you start working with the same people, it's easy because they know what you do, you know what they want. So you kind of stay, not in a rut, but you're just doing the same type of style. Whereas when you get to these new designers, you just have to adapt to what they want. So that also gets you out of your comfort zone and pushing the envelope there.
Do you have a better understanding of what you don't know compared to them?
We know things differently, right? Because I see it as we teach each other. Because there are things that we know also from experience that they may not know. So I'll give you a good example. Someone will run a photometric calculation and you look at it and you know something is wrong. Immediately, it just doesn't make sense, but it's from experience because you know that whatever fixture you're doing with the room, the finishes and all that, the ceiling height, the light output that you ask the person to put in. And I don't know, if you're getting 200-foot candles or you're getting 2-foot candles, something is not correct. So I think there we can go and say, did you check this? Did you check that? But they wouldn't know. And also for us, like we'll say, I don't know, do something in SketchUp and they'll be, no, it's not possible, or it's going to take me 5 hours to do. And you know that it's not an efficient way of doing it. So I think in the end, we know different techniques and we just teach each other. And I don't know, to me, that's like the beauty of it is we're all learning from each other.
Understanding where your experience and your guidance can help somebody look at what they're doing in a slightly different way, to the point of photometrics, right? Growing up in an industry that is so emotive, so emotional, right? Lighting is, it's an emotion to, in my mind. And yeah, you need to have the right amount of light for certain things, but we're artists, we craft things, and you can't solve that part just by looking at the technical aspects. And what schools, you know, they rightfully so, what they have to teach, the things that, you know, are going to be, you know, their education in those systems is focused a lot on, you know, hey, the new technology, the new, you know, these things, right? So as somebody comes in and if their first mindset is, I need to run a photometric of what this space feels like, I have to stop them and say, wait, you just said the word feel. And you're using a technology to create feeling. And that's the hard part.
We're an industry that really straddles this line between like data and metrics and feeling. Like most industries, if you're like a structural engineer, you're going, you just need to make sure something stands up. Like we're trying to capture feeling and like analytic data to prove something. And it's interesting because it causes a lot of clashes, even like in our office, like where it's internal, where someone's, hey, it meets the numbers, it meets the code, it meets this. But then on the other hand, we're like, what does it feel like? So I think that kind of tension allows for us to be a little bit better designers. It's a lot of things can create it. Like a client can create it, internal, like in, like you said earlier, the difference between the two, like a newer generation. I feel like some of the newer generation relies, they have the tools to create really great visual environments. They use visual tools to convey their ideas. We were doing hand sketches and drafting, which are a little bit, you get the idea, but it's not the same. You're not taking 3D space. So I think it's much easier for them to convey ideas and to relay on that kind of aspect, but you have to back it up or through a number. And I think that's the kind of, we could always make it look pretty, but you know, if the client's asking us for X, or we want it to feel like, and I think that's a constant struggle. And through every design process, we always want things to look great, but sometimes we just have to make sure it's lit.
I also see where if somebody is so, you know, they start with all the technical stuff. And then I'm always fascinated when I find out that, you know, somebody's doodling in their, you know, as they're talking, right? And you find out that this person has this talent. They can sketch. Right. And it's so different now to see that. So, you know, our encouragement of this is use that part as well. Right. You know, don't just sketch in the middle of the meeting. But if there's something right, and a presentation doesn't just have to be all about a glow plan or, you know, this perfect image. Right. If you have the ability to draw, that's part of what design is.
It's this concept of visual communication. Right. What are you hoping for? What do you sense is coming with that?
Leadership potential. If we were a static firm that was constantly just doing the same thing, like you were saying, in terms of design, not just in terms of design, but how our business outlook is, right? If I see somebody who's coming in saying, hey, let's look at, you know, D5 rendering, or, you know, these kind of, you know, Enscape, these kind of things, it's telling me as a business owner that they're not just coming in and working, that they have an idea of where their future is going, right? Because it then gives me the thought process that this person is going to really, you know, start to rise in this firm by not just doing what they're supposed to do. It's a weird way of saying that, but that's kind of my thought.
I would say let the new generation grow, also voice their design opinion, right? Not just say, this is how you're doing it. I'll say, I'm telling you, this is how I think I would do it. But there's 50 different ways of doing it. What is your opinion? Not just people shouldn't, we should, I guess, to what you're saying is let the person rise. Because if they're in this industry, they're creative. So to me, it's like, I could say, don't oppress that creativity, that the person just becomes a draft person. They have to be creative. If they're not, then they go to the next company, because very quickly they become unhappy of just you saying, here's that layout, put it in AutoCAD or put it in Revit or do like write a fixture schedule. But it's like you don't specifically need to have a design background then at that point to do these things. Even a photometric, you know, you may not even understand what you're doing. Someone can still do an AGI model if they just give it back to you and you say, well, no, actually change this, change that, until you get to where you need to be. To me, it's letting people express their design.
It's interesting you said giving people space. I think that's something really unique to let people grow as designers and as like people, right? Like, I mean, that's what we're people, we're designers, and people have to know kind of their bounds. Like in theory, like you said, if you're sketching on a piece of paper, like, oh, you're good, like sketch more, dude. And I think the idea of just elevating the team, the industry is really good for everyone. And it exposes us, it challenges us, it challenges them. And I think it moves things forward, like the progress. And with that, like people know what they are good and not good at, or what they like and don't like. It allows them to really move. Understanding yourself allows you to move better in the industry and not be influenced so much by what, you know, the boss says or the industry says, the client says, you know, and it allows you to kind of carve out your own space.
And I will say the new generation, they're not as patient as we were. No. They're not happy. Peace out. We're going to the next company until we find that happiness. Whereas us, we would have said, okay, you know what? We're just going to give it. I think they demand. They want what they want, and they will ask for what they want. If they don't get it, move on.
Nowadays, It's so much more fluid. We're no longer like there's no longer a silo effect in terms of where we're positioning individuals within any of our firms. And I think that's one of the biggest things that we're seeing, you know, or at least I'm seeing as a trend in the design industry is allowing for that opportunity, right? Somebody who's new, they're not going to get as much experience understanding where to put the dots on paper until you take them to a job site, right? You have to invest in that, and they're willing to do that. And then they're willing to understand, I've got to put in some more time because now I'm going to a job site. This is really cool. I get out of the office, but I also know that I have my work to do. And you see that responsibility start to rise.
What's pushing this new way of operating?
I think the new generation demands it. If they ask for it, then you have to, I think they're making us evolve and exactly not wanting, they don't want to stay in that silo. So then they ask for it. And if they ask for it, it's kind of an understatement of saying, I want more. I'm potentially not happy where I'm at. And if that person is talented and you think that this person has growth with the company, then you try to accommodate to let them express themselves and be much more involved in the team or being more of a face that people see on the outside. So listen, me, I admire them for it. I'm like, I wish I was like that when I was like 25 years old.
But I think when we were 25 years old, we also didn't have the, I'll call it societal pressures of social media, all this instant, absolute instant gratification, right? Whether, you know, news is coming at milliseconds, you know, you'll all of a sudden hear something, right? So the patience level is interesting because it's also directly tied to how I see how younger designers are growing up in not to sound weird, but in the world versus how we did, right? There was time that was put in back then, and you did have to do that. But now all of a sudden, they're looking at what their friends are posting. They're looking at what somebody else is showing. And there is a, you know, they're listening to podcasts and they're saying, wait, that person is my age and they're doing this. I need to be at that. So then whether or not they're ready, they're trying to push that as well.
It's the evolution of the industry and workplace culture in a sense. And, you know, it's thinking of it in terms of it allows these, we kind of did things that we were, hey, this is the way it was done before. So this is the way it must be done. And I'm sure we all spent a lot of time with that kind of as the overarching theme, but like, I'm okay with breaking the norms and changing some of the things that, hey, this is the way it was always done. This is the way lighting design always should be done. This is the way you should learn. I think there's now alternative paths. Like what has happened with the lack of patience or access is that people can see things quicker now. They can learn things quicker or pick up on smaller ideas. This kind of shared experience, I think, allows people to demand more, but also expect more and produce more or produce differently.
Do we think, though, that, you know, again, and this all kind of stems from after the pandemic, the idea of the individual is kind of, you know, they're regulating their own, to a certain extent, they seem to be regulating their own growth. But, you know, the idea of where collaboration starts to fall apart in terms of remote working and that whole notion, you know, I think that's one of the things that we have to be careful of. It's kind of a warning sign for, you know, us who are in the industry to see. So I'm curious about that too.
Yeah, you mentioned silos. Like that's like a bad effect. I think there's a lot. Some of the younger generation has kind of grown up in a society where it's much more. I think the in some ways, I think the collaboration is less and it's a little bit focused. Don't want to call it narcissist, but it's very like about me. You post for likes, you want to show off your highlight reels. These are all real things. And I think that's a side effect. I think it's a side effect of it.
People are going back potentially more and more to the office. Is that going to change again in the sense that people are going to learn to collaborating and, you know, to sit at a, like, a meeting table and having a piece of Trace again, right? I don't remember the last time. Since 2020, I haven't used Trace because, you know, it's just kind of a thing of the past in that sense because of the remote work and everything. But is that going to bring people back around a table, you know, of doing little sketches and verbalizing ideas or doodling and getting things like that? I don't know. Because, like, as a New Yorker, I take the subway and I can see that from, I don't know, March 2020 to now. Mm-hmm. Now in the morning, the subway is packed. People are going places. So is that going to, because of that shift again, is that going to change a little bit of this silo?
I think it does a little bit because even for us, like even going, we had some hires that we picked up during like COVID and they were young and now coming back, them not understanding the full collaboration, like what the benefits of it are. Everyone works in their own silos. I'm going to turn on my computer and I'm going to do my little thing. But I think, we're starting to see as people come back, in our office, I feel like there's a benefit. I feel like people are seeing the collaboration and what it can do to get four or five people around the table and say, hey, that's a good idea. Or what about this? I think they're starting to see it. Like we would preach it like, oh, get a piece of Trace. And they're like, that's weird. I'm going to go click on my mouse and make something. But now we're showing it like, hey, it could be this. It could look this way. And we're getting a good response from it.
In an expectation-driven world where everything is moving faster, there's a strong case for technology to help us do that, right? How do you reward collaboration at a higher level than efficiency?
Like now, with people in the office, you have the ability to kind of lean over and say, hey, what do you think of this, right? And it might not be, hey, let's doodle this on Trace, but just yesterday, you know, three of the five of us in the office got on a Teams meeting within our own office to go over plans, right? So we might not be at the conference table, we might not be using the Trace, but at the end of it, it was clear that, you know, there's lessons learned from the, you know, from the junior staff team, that they have a say in this, but they're also learning from just like what we're doing here with our discussions. They're learning from what me and the senior designer are kind of talking about. That sometimes, yeah, maybe laying everything out really quick isn't the best way of doing it. You've got to think about the relationship of how a light works within a space to something else that's architectural.
Is it possible to do that in a demanding world where the deadlines are pressing and clients expect more?
I think there's a struggle with that. I mean, because you said the clients are expecting more. We live in this digital age. We have these Revit and cloud where we're doing markups and stuff is instantly shared with teams. So it's something to try to, I know we've struggled with trying to get the clients and design teams to like slow down a little bit. You guys are designing so fast. You're not paying attention to the small details. Stuff is getting overlooked. Stuff is getting done wrong, but everyone's pushing for a deadline. And in this instant, the activity of the work is moving so fast that I think it's causing a lot of issues. We're always trying to tell like, hey, let's think about this. Client, architects, is this something we want to do? Because if not, you'll get pressured into just churning information. And then we don't even know what we did. We just got it on paper.
The churning of information and the incessant amount of meetings that others are requiring for us to prove that we're succeeding that's something that I think we're at the edge of the cliff with that, right? There's going to be a pushback on that in terms of where we stand with just let us design. You've hired us for something. We know what this process is, and we need to have that ability.
I want to show you guys an image. Can you see that? Yeah. Mm-hmm. How does this apply to what you're talking about?
I mean, because in that image, I mean, that's something where if something starts here and it goes crazy, it'll take the whole project down. I mean, in these small things that are overlooked, can cause really bad things for us as designers, for our clients, and things you can't recover from for just a push to getting stuff out. Yeah, we have to take a step back a little bit.
To me, I think also in the end, if you were, you mentioned efficiencies before, to me, it's inefficient because in the end we push, it's almost like we're going, we're jogging. We're not even walking. We're jogging like 20 steps. And then after those 20 steps, it's like, hold on, we need to go back 5 steps. And then it just keeps this, it becomes like this push and pull because things are, I don't know about you guys, like a lot of times now it's like, oh, we're at 100% CDs. And I'm like, that's barely 100% DD. There is so much stuff that is unresolved.
Yeah, like, you've had 28 meetings.
And exactly. And it's just like, how does that work? How do you build off of that? And that's what I mean. That also becomes inefficient. But in the end, I think for the client, it becomes more costly because things are not resolved. So what's going to happen? Everybody's going to start asking for additional services because your contract is written in a way that you're saying after all these phases,
we're done.
So then it's like, I don't know. To me, it's a little bit counterintuitive or inefficient. But I also call it the COVID effect, that when everybody was at home, like I used to joke that I would, let's say I had a deadline and I'd log off at like 9 p.m. and then I'd get back at my desk at 9 a.m. and I had like already 10 emails in my inbox. And I'm thinking, and sometimes I would literally just look at the time to see what time I got those emails. And it was like 3 a.m, but I know the person is in the same time zone as me. Or on the weekends, you would get all these emails. And I think it was this thing that, hey, we're at home, let's just work, which I don't think is the way to do it because you still need to have a life. But I think from that, mindsets have changed, that people just want these things like super fast. Or it's like the instant gratification, right? You want to see a movie, you go on Netflix, clock, you get the movie. And I think everybody's kind of, or you say the new generation, we're in this world of instant gratification. And I agree with you that it's going to have to push back, yeah.
Before we keep going, I want to spotlight someone who shares the same obsession with the design detail that this podcast is built on. Kelvix doesn't just move fast. They move with purpose, helping the design world turn ambitious ideas into seamless, buildable realities. The Kelvix team works at the pace of your project, delivering tailored solutions backed by the people who know how quality, timing, and precision elevate the final outcome. In every spec and every collaboration, Kelvix proves lighting is more than illumination. Lighting protects design intent, sharpens the details that matter, and brings spaces to life with clarity and ease. See what's coming next from breakthrough products to standout projects at kelvix.com or on their social channels. I also want to take a moment to share another company that I respect and enjoy learning from. At LEDflex, linear light is designed to do more than illuminate. It's engineered to shape how spaces are experienced. Rooted in British manufacturing, LEDflex works alongside lighting designers, interior designers, and architects worldwide, supporting projects where detail, precision, and execution matter. They're not just a manufacturer, they're a technical partner, providing bespoke solutions, rapid prototyping, commissioning, and long-term support from early concept through final handover. If light is integral to your architecture, choose a partner who stays with the project and learn more at LEDflexGroup.com. There's also one more company that I want to introduce you to because they consistently show up where it matters. I know, and you know, every designer knows the success of a space depends on actually what shows up on site. And that's where Diode LED comes in. Lighting performance isn't an add-on. It's the foundation of every successful linear lighting project. Designers need solutions that carry ideas smoothly from specification through installation, and Diode LED is built to support that reality. With industry-leading inventory, reliable delivery, and responsive support, Diode LED keeps pace with real project timelines, not theoretical ones. Real solutions for real projects, no matter the scale. Learn more about what's happening in Reno, Nevada at diodeled.com. Pretty neat, huh? All right, let's get back to the conversation.
As consultants, yeah, right, we're not designing, you know, the whole tower, right? I'm not in charge of the whole thing. I'm in charge of a piece of what we're doing, right? As a result of us having a limited role in a project, we have to have more projects, right? We can't just say, I'm only working on this tower for the next 5 years and keeping the mouths fed. I have to be able to take that one on, but also take the office that's inside there on, or take the park that's down the street, or take someone's house. You add up everything that we need to do as consultants to be successful, right? We're in the profit industry, right? We kind of want to, you know, be profitable. You have to be able to take these smaller projects, but then when you start seeing that every single project is demanding biweekly or weekly meetings, why is the small project that's, you know, someone's one bedroom apartment asking for the same quantity of meetings as the tower? And where do we have the time to design in between that?
I'm curious. What can be good with instant gratification? How does it actually help?
We work on stuff so long. Instant gratification of seeing something finished, completed, is amazing. And it's great to, you know, where we're thinking of ideas where before we were doing glow plans and sketches and all these beam angle studies. So throw it into a rendering and get this amazing 3D virtual space is amazing. So I think, like, to that, I'm okay with some of the instant gratification. I think it's the bigger issue, some of the bigger industry things. It's like the entire project. You can say we're working on a small part, but I think using those little moments where we do get the instant results, the instant gratification, to use it to kind of push forward, but just with knowing that in real life we have to back up the pretty pictures, the instant success.
You said the difference is between instant gratification, being satisfied about this, or the instant result. We don't always have to be instantly gratified with something, but I can be satisfied that if I need to find a specific image of something to quickly show someone, we have the opportunity to do that now instead of what it used to be, right? The ability for us to minimize the time for that kind of research, if we know what we're doing, is much more, it's better.
When you take that opportunity to visually communicate to a client instantly, and you know it's an accurate representation of what your intent is and what they're going to see, does that help or hurt you?
I think it keeps them on focus. I mean, if, you know,
both ways. Because it goes both ways in the sense that, yes, you've given them something to react and something that they're happy about, but because you gave them that instant gratification, they can ask for more instant gratification. So it's like, keep doing it. But again, you know, that to me, it's great. If you pay me to keep doing it, I'll be happy to do it. But then at some point, you know, you each just have to, we may not have the fee for that. And that's where sometimes it's like, yeah, I can keep you happy, but I have to draw the line because it's still a business, right? So.
And for one of the problems with it is we talked about it being like kind of this emotional response from lighting. So people now get these instant results, these instant photos, and they like it. And then they sit on it 2 days and they go, do it. And we're trying to create emotion, but those emotions are like, the responses are feelings, and those feelings can be temporary, and it causes us to do more and more work. So I think while it's helpful, I even like when we give renderings, we try to like tamp it down so it's not like super realistic, and all we try to temper expectations because they come back, well, we don't like the finish, or what about the color, change the fixture, we don't like the size, and you work yourself into a rut. But conceptually, it's it's one of those interesting things you kind of have to work with, but I think that's the, that's one of the problems with it.
When you think about all of this, it's a demand coming from the client side. Let's put ourselves in la la land. Now let's put ourselves in an opportunistic environment for a second. Your best client comes to you today and says, what can I do to make it better? It being your process, the relationship, our ability to succeed. What's the one thing you're asking for?
Trust. Yeah, like you got to trust us. Like that's a common thread. We get hired and then people don't believe us. We're experts and people don't believe us. And I think that's the one thing. Give us, trust us that we know what we're doing, that we can, we're good designers. I think that's the thing I would ask for most.
I would not have said it any other way. You brought a team on of experts. Allow those experts, yes, we have to learn and we have to collaborate and all that, but allow us to do the thing that you've hired us to do.
Agreed.
I want everybody to turn around and look out the window real quick. Bruce, I don't know if you can see it. You can see the Empire State Building right here. You can see the top of that beautiful spike. I'm sitting here listening to you guys talk about this, and I just keep looking at the ESB, and I'm like, what was it like when that thing got designed and built? I mean, it's like, you know, there's these famous photos of what it was like when that was getting built, and you're talking about trace paper, and then there you go. There's JP Morgan right there. It's like 5 months old, right? They're distinguishly different. They're distinguishly profound and pronounced. And your profession is standing the test of time, and it's literally it's in front of all of us here. The city is insane, right? It's just, it's crazy, but it's in some representation. It's what's going on in the world. Like it has to sustain itself. What hasn't changed from the Empire State Building to JP Morgan? Or maybe I should ask, what has changed that we're happy about?
I think there's a belief in constructing something that will make a statement, whether it's iconographic or proving that it can be done, right? You look at how the Empire State Building was built, and then you look at something like 432 Park, where they developed a staircase system specific so that they could keep the tower as minimal as possible, right? Back in the, in the Empire State Building days, they didn't have that technology. So, it's a testament to what we keep saying about technology, right? We have to be players with it, but we also have to understand that that stuff takes time.
Yeah, I would say you look at the skyline, everything at the time was pushing some bounds for the Empire State Building at the time was breaking a lot of rules and norms that people are like, no, you can't do that. You shouldn't do it. And it's being done. I mean, I think in different scales and different contexts, but I mean, I think the core of that is something that's unique to looking at the skyline that kind of unites all these buildings is people are like, hey, let's see how tall we can go. Let's try. I mean, it's happening. It was here. It was in Chicago. It's in Dubai. It's still this common thing. And I think the tech behind it and the idea, I think the pure design behind it is something that unites kind of all of architecture.
I was going to say, to me, it's still designers. It's still architects, interior designers. That hasn't changed. It's the technology that is changing to allow for things to be built differently. So it was funny you were saying for the Empire State Building when it was built, someone was still drafting. And, they probably were using carbon paper to make copies. So in the sense that you were not printing things that easily because it took a while. When I went to interior design school, I still had a T-square or a parallel ruler. And when I did my presentations, I had my ink pens and everything. Let's just say the design was not changing every 5 minutes because You just could not produce that fast. So I think that's the thing. It all goes back to technology, is how things can be done faster because of the aid of a computer that before you just didn't have.
You can iterate faster. You can visually communicate better. You can do so much more with technology.
Sorry, I'm going to interrupt you. I sort of disagree that you can visually iterate better. Because to me, a hand sketch can still tell a story. Sometimes I find that as beautiful as they are, those photorealistic renderings, sometimes they lack personality. So I think there are things that have been done for hundreds of years that are still valid, that they will still get that message across. Sorry, I just wanted to put that out there.
That methodology to visually communicate for the Empire State Building, the intentionality almost had to be that much more trusted, that much more thought through, or maybe not thought through, but stuck with, from the standpoint of it wasn't easy to change, right? I'm curious, when you look at your individual practice today of sticking to your guns, is it hard to do that because people know you can change faster?
Do you stick to your guns for everything? Do you? I don't know.
And I think I would like to. In La La Land, I would like to be able to stick to my guns. But I know there's too many moving parts to these teams to do that. And I think there might be specific projects or places where where it's like, this is a line in the sand, like we cannot. But then you have to be flexible. I mean, we're still on a team. And I think that outline that changes a little bit for us.
We've always called it the three strikes rule. You know, we have a mindset of what's going to be the right solution for this, right? And we haven't, it's based on, you know, constructability, it's based on feasibility, it's based on budget, it's based on, you know, time frame. So we tell somebody what our solution is, right? They chat, you know, well, what about this? Well, okay, you can't because of one of those four reasons. They do it again, right? After the third time, it's a waste of our time to keep trying to convince somebody of something they're never going to listen to. That's why we call it the three strikes rule. But here's the other thing, right? Empire State Building, right? And Chrysler Building, if I am not mistaken, they were going up at the same time. One of them had to have the tallest spire before the other one, right? In Chrysler Building, they hid their spire within the tower, right? So do you think that they were still sitting around a table saying, you know, maybe we should put this finial, you know, 3 feet higher? They're like, no, we got to get this done because next week these guys are going to be the tallest building in the world. So, you know, sometimes you have to stick to your guns just, you know, as a matter of some other event that's happening.
We're going to come back to this one. I got to put it out there. I want to talk about which one of these will be more impressive 100 years from now, because they're both still going to be standing, and how that's going to be judged, and how, you know, the periods of design will be judged. But you can argue, I think, there's trends that influence a lot of this. And I'm curious, in your world, what's trending? Where does it come from? How does it stick? How do you get rid of it?
How do you deal with it?
Being in this kind of connected world, I think there's so many good ideas and designers that things come out. And I think we kind of live in a copycat world a little bit. So as soon as someone sees something as a good looking project or a product that sells well or showed up in a magazine, we kind of quickly attach to it. I'm not sure who's responsible for it. I think they kind of happen. It happens, and there's nothing wrong with trends. I don't think all of them would get appreciated. I like, in terms of design, I always kind of like designing in trend sometimes, and I think it's fine. I think we always kind of look at things in this classical architecture, these kind of, oh, what stands the test of time? What's the traditional, like, what'll stand up? Sometimes I'm okay with doing for what it is at the moment. If it's really bad 20 years from now, they'll replace it. It's fine. And as a designer, I'm kind of okay with that, because it's kind of evolution. Like you paint a room in your house and you or you put in shag carpet and then you realize 15 years later that was the worst idea anyone ever came up with, you're changing your depth. And I think I kind of like it, but I mean, hey, trends, I'm okay with them.
It's funny you're saying trends and then things that are timeless. I don't know. I don't know if you guys have been to Falling Waters, you know, and you go in that house and it could have literally been designed today. Like that house, somehow it's still going to stay current. No matter how long it's out there, it's still somehow it feels current, which to me is timeless. But there are certain environments where I think it is trendy. And to me, I think a lot of the office environment. How many times have we gone to an office and we're like, oh, that was designed in the 80s, you know, because of the materials, the type of light fixtures and everything. But theoretically, it's going to change, right? It's a new tenant or technology has changed. I don't know. There's a new camera that they want to use and it affects the lighting, affects the camera. So things are going to change. So I think it's nice that there is this evolution as well. And for certain environments, like, I don't know, I'm looking here at this donut above the bar. You know, it's kind of on trend now, or those linear slots that are very slim and everything. But in 10 years, are we going to go away from that? We have the lens fixtures, but the louver's making a comeback. Yeah. So things evolve. But I say, to me, it's like fashion, right? Things just come and go, and they adapt to the technology of the time.
One of my favorite lines from any movie came from L.A. Story, when Steve Martin was taking, I forget who it was, around Los Angeles, and he with the most serious face, he's like, some of these buildings are 20 years old. And the way he said it, you know, it's like, oh, yeah, that's, you know, this is, it just, it makes me laugh every time. Because, you know, we are in an industry that's, it's a temporary industry. There's, you know, yes, a building's going to last 150 years, right? That's great. But how many times has that been renovated? How many times did they change the lights on the facade of the Empire State Building, right? You know, we are in an industry that is trendy because the architecture is trendy. The interior design is trendy. If you had your choice to go to a place in Las Vegas right now, would you go to the
Luxor
casino
every day of the week?
What's that?
The Luxor every day of the week.
Yeah. Oh, I was thinking the one next door. You know, Excalibur was a great thing back in the day. So all of what we do in whether it's residential or hospitality, or, you know, we do a lot of sports arenas, you know, these kind of venues, institutional, right? Even religious institutions, right? There is a time frame that something will last before somebody says this no longer works. So for us, trend isn't just about, yeah, we should be doing, you know, a trimless square fixture that's a half inch aperture, and, you know, that's just part of the kit of parts. But if we're coming into a design and saying something that, you know, hey, we should be doing this, and somebody looks at us and say, but that was what we did in the year 2000, that we're not going to get another job. You have to be trendy.
I mean, one thing I'm curious, like, we're working on these projects, and I'm curious to see what those projects look like in the ones that are still standing in 30 years, like where we're designing things now, and we're like, oh, we think this is cool, and then we're going to come back and it's going to be the shag carpet of lighting, or, you know, like the polyester suits. And I'm curious to know which of my projects will I go, timeless or polyester suit.
You guys are all seasoned enough. Is there a trend in your world that you're seeing already disappear?
The slot, it's like, how many manufacturers now you see have brought the louver back? Which I think is a great thing because it's controlling the glare. But things change. I don't know. So I do a lot of residential work. And because of LEDs and energy and lamps being phased out, now I'm at the point that sometimes a house that was completed 20 years ago, the clients are calling because, hey, you know what? We need to change. We don't want to use that MR16 halogen anymore. But other than potentially the source, they want to change the lighting because of energy and going to LEDs. But when you look at the place, it still looks beautiful, meaning that there is a little bit of that timeless sense to it, that if they change the light fixtures in another 20 years, it's still going to look beautiful. So it goes both ways, but we are at a point now with LEDs and what the energy codes and things like that are mandating, or lamps getting phased out, that there is this thing that people are going to have to change. Yeah. But it doesn't mean that you're redoing the whole design. You may tweak certain things, especially like if ceilings are getting opened and things like that. But it's not, you may not always redesign, because what you did 20 years ago still works. But to Bruce's point, sometimes you'll go to a place that you did 10 years ago and you're like, oh, like today I would do this completely differently. It goes both ways.
Trend will update based on time. But the bigger things that I'm noticing that are changing is, you know, controllability, right? Mm-hmm. Dim to warm, you know, these topics that weren't around back in the day because you had an incandescent light bulb, right? Now you have to give somebody this whole education on the benefits of Dolly or the benefits of tunable white or the benefits of, you know, these technologies that will cost more. And now, because there's more components, have more problems if, you know, with maintenance. But that's the stuff that everybody needs to start understanding in order to make it look timeless, in my mind.
We're going to be busy at some point because it's just, you know, it's old buildings that have fluorescence, incandescent, or like bipins, compact fluorescence, and they have to change them. By law, they won't be able to keep those.
And this is a trend that I'm starting to see completely different in terms of what our role in the lighting design society is. It was almost like back when fluorescent 2x2s changed over to an LED, right? There's a lot of rep agencies. There's a lot of manufacturers who are doing this. And we are honestly starting to see more and more of those agencies take this piece of design, right? And know most of what they need to do, but there are agencies that are bringing on lighting design firms to help them to do some of the parts, right? Yeah, I could replace, you know, all of this stuff with the right controls, but hey, lighting design, you know more about the emotion, the mood, and all this stuff. Can we hire you guys, right? So it's not just clients that are bringing us in, it's agencies that are looking too.
Because one of like the trendy thing, like we talk about trends and we talk, they could be the light fixtures, how things look. But one thing that you mentioned is like the technology. The trends of the technology is something that we're also playing with. Instead of just creating this vision for the space, we are having to keep up with the technology trends and the speed at which the technology is changing. And I think that's an interesting thing. We always find it challenging because you're wanting to create a space. But for example, all the manufacturers, we got to a point where slots, 4-inch slots became a thing with fluorescent. Then LED happened, and then it was 4-inch slots, it was 3-inch slots, it was 2-inch slots. Like, the technology kept improving to do this, and we're trying to keep up to have the state-of-the-art cutting-edge technology and really cool design, in that it's kind of hard to kind of manage both of them at the same time because they don't necessarily work together as they're pushing technology, which maybe doesn't solve all the problems, but we need, they're doing things just to do them. So like tech trends, corporate interior trends, and kind of just general lighting. I mean, I think that's things we've all kind of had to deal with. And one of the things I found interesting is that sometimes I feel the client is in some ways becoming a little bit more informed, maybe not fully, but more informed than sometimes can be a little dangerous. Like they know enough to talk about it, but not, right, it could be dangerous, and that's this kind of land we're kind of in, to figure out trends and navigating what someone now has found out because they've sat on a PowerPoint. Now they're like, oh, I know lighting now. And you're
yeah, because also, you know, you can ask the question and the AI is gonna respond, and then they tell you the AI told me this, or I went on Google and I found this, and you're trying to break it down. Not to say that it's not true, but it may not be the full picture.
Yeah.
So I think as lighting designers, we're not only just designers, but we're educators, because especially with this new technology, well, not, it's no longer new, but with the technology that we are in now, which is much more of an electronic, we that is constantly evolving, we just have to keep educating people of the pros, the cons, the dangers of doing something, or, you know,
the consequences.
The consequences, I shouldn't say dangers, yes, the consequences. But it's just like we're there, like, we have to also keep up with that technology so that we can explain it to people. And sometimes we have to explain it in like very basic terms, right? It may not be the terms we would use that as we're talking to each other, but as talking to someone that doesn't know what these terms are.
It's interesting how you casually slide that word education in there. There's deep, deep meaning behind that statement. What's the most important thing the design community can stand up and educate their peers and their owners about when it comes to lighting right now?
I think we're still educating about LEDs, even though we've been using it for, what, 10, 15 years. But we're still educating because it is ever evolving.
Is it your job to educate the marketplace about LED?
I would.
If we want the right fixtures.
Exactly. I think if we want something, or because there are so many options, it is our role as designers to give our clients options and telling them what we recommend and why we recommend it. Or again, some clients think that they know, or their friend told them something, and then they come and they tell you, how about this? Well, you still have to do the research to understand potentially if they want. It's like once I had a client, somehow they wanted a red light in the shower because it had some health benefit and everything. So it's obviously, I don't know exactly. But in the end, you know, it's then you have to do the research. What is this red light? What is it that they're doing? Is it potentially just a, like I'll say, a hoax or something that, you know? But in, you have to, if your client asks for things, you have to be able to respond to them in an intelligent manner.
Sometimes I just want to say no.
Yeah, but you may just want to say no, but you can't flat out just say no. So that's the thing. You have to do the research and try to say, like, not say just no, but how do you say no in a different, in many, many more words?
Formative no.
Exactly.
You also have, from the other end of the spectrum, right, you are brought on by this person who wants their project done, right? So you have to have the knowledge that when someone else comes with a alternate idea or an alternate fixture or an alternate, you know, time frame for something, we have to be the ones to say, well, do you still want this? Because if you want this, what's being offered is not viable, right? We have to be the ones who also say, where are you willing to compromise, right? You want the red light in the shower, right? But what happens if the fixture that comes next week is this weird amber color that's almost red, right? Because the contractor said, this is the only thing I could find, right? Are you willing to put up with that? Like, it's, we have to stay knowledgeable of everything so that we could point out the stuff that nobody else is looking for.
Because to that point, like, staying knowledgeable, because a lot of times people ask requests and they don't even know what they're really asking for. I want the red light, but why? I saw it on Instagram. But for us, it's to stay knowledgeable, to actually pull that information from the client. Like, what are you really after? Are you looking for health benefits? Do you just want to look cool? Like, so I think those are things, yeah, to stay knowledgeable, we really need to be able to understand the technology, the lighting, and what the client, connect with the client and try to understand what they actually want. Because a lot of times we are in projects where they don't really know, but they saw a cool picture and that's it.
In the end, you become almost like an investigator because you have to ask different questions to make sure that what they're telling you is really what they want. Yeah. Because it's completely, you potentially will give them what they want, but what they're telling you is not what they, what that want is. It's, okay, let me ask the question in five other ways, and then I'll get to, this is really what you want.
So who's setting the trends? Is it the internet? Is it the client? Is it the lighting designer? Is it the architect?
It's everybody.
I think it's a little bit of everyone.
But I think fundamentally, it comes usually for designers asking for something for a project that potentially it starts as a modification or customized product, and then it they go running with it, right? So, for example, I think of something as simple as the slots. Because of LEDs, now that we have, you know, slots that are half an inch, but I think potentially someone said, I have this residential, not this, sorry, this commercial tower, and I need, I don't know, 100,000 linear feet of this thing for my project. Can you make it at half an inch wide? And okay, let's go back. We'll study how to get you the light level, the light output that you need, because we want that job. We want that 100,000 linear feet of fixtures.
We'll fight with every other manufacturer for that.
Yeah. You know, I think some of the interesting things when coming, looking at it from the manufacturing side, I think some of it was, some of the stuff we did, trends we came out of tech, born out of the industry. You know, it was a slot fixture, it was a parabolic louver, it was this cones and all sorts of things. And, you know, and I think that started a lot of trends. We're like, oh, we didn't realize we actually needed this type of fixture, and now we can put it everywhere. I worry sometimes about the industry and commodifying, like turning what turned into a solution as a slot fixture. And now instead of them necessarily looking for the next thing, it's like, everyone, let's make that thing because people like it. So I feel like sometimes the manufacturer could help support us by pushing some newer designs. Sometimes manufacturers want to capture dollars. I understand why, but sometimes they force a lot of products on us that maybe we didn't ask for. Or
the other thing about this is, and you guys can correct me if I'm wrong, but I don't think there's ever been a project where the lighting design is what has driven the design of the project initially, right? There's the, you know, we're in a very reactive industry, right? And so, yes, we could be trendy in terms of the specifics, but we take our cues from what's given to us. We can adapt the architecture to what we're doing, but in the end, we do have to just, at some points, we are the second string, right? We're the ones who are, I'm going to make your place look as beautiful as it is, even though it's the ugliest building I've ever seen. You know, no, all our buildings are beautiful. But it's a process, right? We have to understand what our place is in the role of design.
So it's interesting. You're talking about the manufacturers, and I will pose the question. To me, I feel that since we've changed to LEDs, a lot of what was going on in the industry was adapting fixtures to LEDs. But now I'm like, okay, we know how to use LEDs. We know how we've adapted them to all the other sources that we've used before. Give me something new. I'm looking for that great new fixture that I haven't seen. Like, I'm ready for it. It's just like, give me something new. Like, try doing different things.
And to like what Martin just said, it's not about something glitzy and glamoury or like sexy. It's like, give me a fixture that helps me enhance the trends that I'm secondary to when it comes to architecture? Like, where's the real technological innovation around, I guess, everything behind the scenes, right? I'll go back to La La Land for a second because it's physically impossible, but my favorite analogy is like, someone give me Bend a Beam. Light goes 20 feet and just turns left, right? like if someone could just come up with Bend a Beam, you would just put, you know, 8 lights right here down the side in line with architecture and the light would magically get to where it needs to go. How do you create some form of Bend a Beam to allow you as a designer to focus on intent and in enhancing the space and being being secondary, but giving you the time back in your bucket to not have to worry about what sounds like has become a pretty big burden of having to educate people about every part of what you're specifying now?
I don't see it as a burden. Do you?
It's not a burden. It's just, sometimes it's unnecessary to constantly be looking for something trendy just to make something successful. I've always held the philosophy that you need to look good in this space. You need to feel good in this space. Sometimes you don't know why, right? But what trend is starting to do is to create these things where they're so visible that it is an obvious philosophy of I have to be the one that's showcased, right? Well, if I'm the one who's showcased, if I'm the lighting design, you know, if my lighting design is so important that somebody's saying, wow, look at that. That is, look at what that light did. Then what is that doing for us to support the entire design process? There's time for wow factor, but I think there's also time for understanding what our role is in, again, going back to the emotion, what makes me feel correct in the space, whether it's an office or a church or a residence.
I want to take a moment to recognize a team that understands what every designer already knows. Light isn't a fixture, it's the soul of a space. For almost a century, Targetti has shaped how people experience architecture, using precision optics, performance, and that unmistakable sense of Italian design to elevate every moment a space offers. Because light isn't just seen, it's felt. It drives emotion, guides the eye, and transforms intention into atmosphere. For Targetti, light isn't simply the medium, it's the identity. It's the craft, the legacy, and the commitment behind every solution they create. Experience it for yourself. Visit TargettiUSA.com. Now, let's jump back into this conversation.
You had the best question. It's what role can we actually play in sustainability right now?
Yeah, because, and I think I agree with both of you. To me, it's like it's a word that, a trending word. Like, you know, it's a good marketing strategy. Like, we did a sustainable building or office or whatever. But everything essentially that makes the fixture is imported from somewhere. And that's, again, it's not just lighting, it's everything, the brick, the marble, the everything.
Yeah, sustainability is a mindset, right? It's not a checkbox, to your point. It is a buzzword. It is trend. But it's just this concept of basically thinking about everything we do. You know, do we want to do it as wastefully as possible, or do we want to do it as sustainably as possible? When you look at being as sustainable as possible, possible being maybe the key word in this conversation, what are you doing right now that is possible?
I think one of the things we can do, or some of the things, is looking at some of the manufacturers. We talked about stuff from shipping, and you mentioned about things lasting long, but we do a lot of corporate interior work. And with that, corporate interiors last almost as long as a lease. So in some cases it's 10 years, some cases it's 30. And I think sometimes these sustainability goals, which are much larger and long-term, for us, we're starting to look at ways and manufacturers that can do replacements and do we can set things up knowing that someone was going to come in and gut it, but maybe if they want to keep it, they could, or they can replace a trim. Or if we know ultimately the stuff is going to get ripped out and trashed, what can be recycled? What are the materials they're using to build the housings? So we're starting to spend a lot of time looking into the components that we specify and how well those things can be reused or recycled, ultimately knowing that they're going to get ripped out every 10 years because design trends and a new tenant and a new thing. So for us, we're looking at a much more of a practical day-to-day kind of worry about sustainability.
Or it could be, you know, that I don't think it exists, like almost like a charity or an organization that takes, you know, those light fixtures that will reuse them because they're still the ones, like if it's a 10-year lease, that LED is still going to work, right? That someone reuses it in a place, you know, that has a low budget or no budget. So I think with light fixtures or even furniture, there's a possibility of doing these things.
It could also be as simple as the notion that you don't need that much regulatability in a room, right? If I'm seeing something where a zone is only has one or two fixtures on it, right? Starting to look at that and say, do you really need that? Because now that's running this much more wire from that fixture to back to a control system. Now it's also adding another circuit. It's adding all this stuff, right? So the behind the scenes stuff, if we can combine that in this instance with this zone over here, now all of a sudden it's not reducing the quantity of lights in the ceiling, it's reducing the stuff behind the scenes. And in that sense, it's reducing what we're using in terms of materiality. You know, the next generation of lighting designers, with all their technical knowledge, with their understanding of what photometrics mean, with all of that, they can help us start to look at, we don't necessarily need to have something with a 2000 lumen output that we're just going to dim down. We're going to look at something that might have a lower wattage, might be able to use something that's less, that again, energy, not sustainability, but it gives that ability for technology to help start driving some of those decisions to reduce the componentry behind.
That you hit on something, like I think also with LEDs, we're at a point that everybody's trying to get so much more light out of the fixture, but sometimes you don't need that much light, but then you no longer have an option of going to a lower light output because the word is, well, just dim it down. But sometimes, like I do residential towers in a corridor, the developer is not spending money for a dimmer. Mm-hmm. So then then you have to go to the manufacturer and you say, can you underdrive this fixture for me? Because I don't need the lowest light output that you have. It's just way too much light. And then also you have in the end the energy code that says, well, you can't use all these downlights in this corridor. It's like it throws you just don't meet the code. So I think there's that also, is that everybody's like, yeah, LEDs are getting better and better. They are more and more efficient. Let's use them to the maximum efficiency. But sometimes it's too efficient for certain needs. You know, like your tape light. Sometimes you just need 100 lumens for what? But then you have your minimum is like 400 lumens. It's like, well, I don't need that extra 300 lumens. And potentially I don't need to dim it. So to me, I think that's being sustainable, and that goes to the manufacturers as well.
It's interesting to me because we're speaking here holistically of the sustainable mindset, this opportunity to not be wasteful, right? But to be mindful. Yet the design trend is built around the checkbox, for lack of a better term. How do you see the progression? Let's just go within the next year. Is it the mindset or is it the checkbox that's going to that's going to dominate the market.
Still, it's a checkbox in my mind. It takes a lot of effort to change a society. And I'm going to admit it, when LEED started, we had done a project where they hired an accounting firm to make sure that we had enough points so that that building could be the largest LEED silver project in the world. It had nothing to do with, our mindset of sustainability or mindset, right? So somebody sees that and they say, oh, this is increasing my rent value. This is increasing the property value, right? They want that plaque on the side of a building. So in my mind, it is still a checkbox for people outside the design industry. Oh, well, Bob has this down the street, so I need this so that I could have the same rent. It has nothing to do with I want to be the environmental good guy.
You see, there's a lot of architecture firms that are pushing all these ideas for net zero, and there's these sustainable goals. And I think that's a good thing to try it. In practice, we're also battling against the cost of what does it mean to be sustainable. And I think where there are some people making headway into changing mindsets, it comes down to a dollar, and it comes down to a timing of the project, and all people dedicating resources to make that happen. And I think right now, I don't think it's there yet where people are really, the mindsets are shifting from the people who are writing the checks.
Is it the architect or is it the developer, owner, person with the checkbook driving sustainability the most right now?
It's the person with the checkbook. Typically, yeah, they're the ones that ask for it. I think you have some people that truly believe in sustainability and they want to do it for their buildings, and you have some people, it's literally just a marketing strategy.
Can lighting be more sustainable if there's a stronger focus on the materials or the energy usage?
I think the easy one is energy. I think that's still something that everyone can do right away, very simply. I think the materials changes it, because we're working with what we have available to us. And I think manufacturing and fabrication, there's a lot more components and factors to make that work. And so for us, the easy checkbox is energy. But
what I think we need to have in the lighting world is a better relationship with some of these regulatory decision makers to understand what we need to be sustainable. And we just finished this project that we've been working on in Florida for, I don't know, 5 or 6 years now. And there is a major component of this project, based on its shoreline, based on where it's located, that there needed to be compatible fixtures with turtle-friendly a turtle-friendly environment. The quantity of manufacturers who were making something to that extent, right? Where, this isn't about, sustainability in this sense is helping something else in this world, right? The quantity of fixtures that were available to be used could not be used on this project because they didn't have enough people in the agency to approve those fixture types for usage. And that sounds really weird, but we were stuck using fixtures that were 10 years behind us, right? Light bulbs, looking at actual light bulbs instead of LED fixtures. So here you have an agency that's dictating that you need to be sustainable but doesn't have the bandwidth to create the dialogue with the manufacturers who are trying their best to do this to give you this ability to be sustainable. It's a conundrum.
I want to take a right turn with this conversation because it is the right way to go. What is one thing that you feel like you do today that you're steadfast and rooted in that maybe even you don't agree with, or the design community otherwise, you know, says, no, I don't do it that way, but you do because, well, you tell me why.
Being in the industry for long enough, we get complacent in certain mindsets, whether it's, you know, what fixtures we use because they worked on something else, or what design firms we work with because we're used to those, or, you know, there's any method to staying on the path of least resistance, right? And I'm as guilty as anyone, right? It goes with technology, right? I've been told I've been technologically conservative, it's not a badge of honor, but it's also, you know, we get to these points where you're dealing with so much, you're running a business, you're handling new people coming in, you're dealing with clients who aren't paying, all of this stuff, that it gets you to a point where as much as you want to understand what is the new thing out there, what are these new things, it's so much easier to stay in your lane and say, all right, you know what? You guys were happy with this last time. We're just going to keep going with that.
Sometimes I wish that maybe I use different manufacturers or do things a little bit differently. Obviously, different projects require different things. But in the end, it's like, okay, you're looking for this type of fixture. These are the same X manufacturers you're going with. And I get complacent. And instead of potentially giving somebody else a chance, and it's just because it's just like it's the rat race in the end. It's, you're just trying to, you know, get things done. And it's like, again, why fix it if it's not broken?
No, it's interesting because it's always kind of this battle for capacity. And we've talked earlier on about how things happen so quickly and so fast. We don't necessarily, not every project, I don't shame to admit this, not every project gets the same amount of attention as all projects, you know, and I wish I could give everything, but the capacity becomes an issue, and that puts you in a spot where you're being complacent or not pushing or the path of least resistance. It's something I wish was something completely different, and trying to make it different. Don't know if it's possible, but like on the wish list of things, that's one of them. And I think for me, that's something I know it and something I wish to change immediately. Like, but it's, I'm working against the grain, and it's a difficult spot to be in, but, I'm hopeful that it will, shift.
If you're stuck in complacency, the rat race, how does this industry from like a technological basis and product basis and everything move forward if you don't have the time to give something else an opportunity?
We're in a weird spot where technology is pushing us past what our comfort zone is. And we're teetering on this edge of like, oh, all this new stuff is really possible. And we just haven't cracked the code yet, or, you know, we've put our toe in the pool, but we haven't really tried it. And I think there's some elements that could really allow us to become better designers by giving us giving our time back to design, do what we wanted to do, what we were meant to do, do what we want to do. I think that's part of it.
Do you have a specific thing you can share?
There are these times where you're inundated with Zoom calls and basically just sending information and trying to relay. If I could have someone be able to, like, I had a program that could check all the light levels, I didn't have to spot check things in real life on a job site, or easier ways to transcribe punch list efforts to go, oh, every single fixture in here is damaged, and I have to now tell the contractor and I have to explain why. Like, just small moments, if I could get my time back to not have to worry about some of those little things, I think I'd be a much better designer, a much more efficient designer, and being able to design with purpose instead of just designing out of complacency.
We have to listen to the people who we are, again, I bring this back up, the people who we are bringing in to work with us, right? Because if we are complacent in what we do and just saying, do it this way, you know, the firm's not going to survive. So what we need to do is we also need to, you know, they might not know all of the ins and outs, but the individuals who are the junior designers, who are the designers, who are the project managers in our firms, if we don't listen to them saying, hey, I talked with someone from Natalie's firm, right? That, you know, and they're doing it this way, we should probably look at that. And this gets into this whole notion of, I think that the design world itself, we have all these great individual firms, and we've got all these great committees and all this stuff, but we all have to start understanding that it's okay to share your strengths and your failures among firms as well, right? Because if we're going to grow this design industry better, right, if I screwed something up so badly, right, and you're in the same position, but you don't have that knowledge base, the, you know, just email someone or pick up the phone or do something, just meet somebody for a drink and say, I'm going through this, right? You're going back to the siloing, right? A firm is staying itself and it's never going to grow.
Do you want to share something?
If all of a sudden somebody comes in and says, you know, hey, we've got this new project. It's a museum, right? And I've never done a museum before, right? Or have I? I don't remember. No offense to any museums I've done. But, you know, if I don't know what I'm doing on that project, right? Yeah, I want to take on that challenge. But we have experts who know that, right? So why would I try and fail at what I'm doing, right? Just because I don't want to share a trade secret with someone. Admit our humbleness and say, hey, guys, you know, I'm in the process of doing this design. What did you do? What'd you learn from this, right? It's not about I'm stealing your client. It's not about I'm stealing your design thought process. It's where do I need to focus on so that I can stay efficient and I can stay profitable?
I will say with our generation and hopefully going after us, it is changing. There's definitely much more, I wouldn't say friendliness, but we're more willing to ask each other for something. Like, I don't know, if I'm doing a display case and I know someone does museum lighting, I'll call that person and say, or email them and say, hey, I'm doing this type of thing. Which manufacturer do you recommend that I go to? The person is going to give me that information. Again, I'm not telling them to do the design for me. It's just a little bit of guidance. And I think we're much more open to that than our predecessors.
You know, the only way to survive it is to get through it. And that leads me to my last question. What makes you feel most alive when you're doing what you do for a living?
Seeing the pride that other people have in what's been completed is a huge thing, right? The ability to understand, we chose this path, right? I'm an architect by training, a licensed architect, right? And all my friends still architects. And, you know, for them to say, you did that, right? There's a pride in that. But I think that the thing that keeps me super excited is seeing a project as it's completing come out the way that you wanted it, despite all of the obstacles that we just went through for the last X number of years, right? That there is still this notion that we did this, we're successful. And to share that with, rightfully so, with the people who helped it, right? It's not, you know, our firm isn't just the partners. And that's a thing to watch too, is to see somebody else start to take that pride in what they're doing and go tell their friends. That gets me every time.
Do you feel like you have to protect that? Is that sacred or?
Oh, I just wish more people would have that. You know, I mean, this is what we do, right? You know, yeah, we're designing these, you know, we're designing something that somebody's going to see for 100 years, right? 200 years, right? Be proud of that, right? Do what you need to do to be that successful that somebody after your generation is going to be, you know, talking about it. Whether they're talking about it in a good way or a bad way, they're still like, you know, they're going to say, hey, somebody thought of that. You know, that's kind of, that's cool.
For me, I think in the sense of seeing the projects completed, but I feel in the process of problem solving, not even at the end of it, because the end, it's nice because you see it's done and it's great and people see it and you can see it and you're like, ah, that looks cool. But I really enjoy the process, like the solving the puzzle, like figuring out, you have 1,000-piece puzzle and now you've gotten the borders and the corners together and you're like, now we're starting to roll. To me, that's like I love that part of it. As soon as you get into like full stride in a design project, you know, and cause that's what we're designing. We're trying to figure out the problem. We're trying to solve the problem. And that's, you know, make this lighting work for this particular space. Yeah. Mid-race is the best part for me.
Well, it's the beginning and the end. So the design aspect, you know, when you're starting, you know, to figure out what the design is going to be, obviously you go through the good, the bad, the ugly as the project along the way. And then obviously the finished product, just seeing, and I will say sometimes even if it's even more gratifying if it's been a complicated project, that there were multiple challenges, whatever those challenges are. And then you get there and you see that it is still beautiful. Or even sometimes when you have a very small budget, but that with that very limited budget, we are still able to do something that is beautiful, that is not just, I don't know, I'll say putting 2x2s in a grid ceiling, right? That to me, that's what keeps me going is, yeah, just going through the motions and having that finished product, no matter what means of ease or complications you got through that product.
Yesterday, I was at a job site yesterday, and it wasn't the smoothest project. It had all sorts of difficulties. It changed hands. It got VE'd. It dropped. It got put on pause. It got picked up. And I was thinking to myself on the drive, like, there's no way this project is going to look. This is going to look horrible. And I was really afraid it was going to, and got there and it was amazing. And then, you know, we're looking at, like, I remember all the struggles of the project. It's like, well, we couldn't get the detail to work right and they didn't give us enough space and we compromised here. And we compromised on that thing and they VE'd us on that. And when we went to look, I was like, huh, we actually did a good job on those details. Like the detail we were complaining about and hating actually turned out we did a good job on it. Like, and it's, I think sometimes we forget to celebrate our own victories, whether they're small or not, and give ourselves a pat on the back. And after that project was like, yeah, pat on the back, like round of drinks for everyone because it actually looks good. And you forget that sometimes. And then usually for us, we tend not to see even the end of the project. We go from kind of the design work, we release the stuff, we punch list, and then we're on to the next project. Like architects are like, oh, by the way, the project's done. And we're like, oh, great. Like now we can look. So we don't even, a lot of times we don't even get a chance to celebrate. We're going on to the next, so it's nice to see something completed and I have to take a victory lap and, you know, say cheers with the team.
The interesting thing that the three of us literally just described was enjoying the beginning, the middle, and the end of the process. So, like, that means, you know, we love what we do.
Yeah.
That's the best part. It's not situational. It's every part of what we do. We take that love.
I cheated because I told you it was my last question. But then I came up with one more. Beginning, middle, and an end. I like it, right? You love what you do. You've been doing it for so many years, and you'll continue to do it. So as you look to the future, let's just go 5 years out. I'll say it out loud. It will be 2030. right? What do you hope for in the profession of lighting design in 5 years, in 2030?
Having been in lighting for 20 plus years, there are certain things that were easier to do.
Yes.
The whole, the client buying the project and the VE and the distributor, the contractor, everybody sort of trying to, I will say, think they know better than you. To me, I wish that we went back in time to the way it was a little bit simpler. That's like a big wish for me. Because in the end, we spend so much time trying to sort these things, and it takes away from the design, right? We're just like on the phone talking to the reps, like everybody, to make sure that in the end, it is a good fixture or good fixtures. The project is going to turn out as beautiful as we intend, but that's taking away from that design period that we could give potentially to another project, because the ship has sort of sailed on that one, if I can say it. So that's one of my wishes.
In 2030, besides flying cars, I think I'm looking at a way where we can share this, what we know as lighting designers and these experiences we create, kind of to the more general public, right? So lighting designers on any given project, a lighting designer is a luxury good. We're not on the cheap projects. We're not on, and, you know, I guess we could be, you know, but I would like that all projects get a lighting designer, and maybe I'm biased, but there's benefits to creating these environments that people interact with. There's health benefits. There's, you know, just general emotional experiences we can craft through lights, and they shouldn't be reserved for high-end places or exclusive places. And a lot of times our designs fall there because they're in corporate, you know, corporate interiors or people, wealthy homes. And I think if we can kind of spread this wealth of knowledge that we have and have it like literally to disseminate to all levels, I think that would be good. I think that's something we should all kind of strive for that. I'm piggybacking on Light Justice. They have a equity in light. And I think that's a really strong idea that no one should be cheated out of good lighting.
And good lighting doesn't have to be expensive.
And that the educational system in this country improves to let others understand we exist. There's always been this, it's been hard, and we're finding it hard to find, hire new talents, right? It's a constant thing. I just talked with somebody yesterday about it. And, you know, just the idea of hopefully in the next few years, the higher education world, not just in, you know, Colorado, places where lighting is actually a major, but in an architectural world, architecture school, they allow people the understanding that this is a viable profession. Somebody, right, if you're talking, and you go back to like elementary school, right, you know, what do you want to be when you grow up, right? I want to be a fireman. I want to be a basketball player. I want to be a ballerina, whatever it is, right? These are the mindsets. I don't want, you know, some three-year-old to say, I want to be a lighting designer. That sounds really weird. But if you don't have an ability in an education system to advance a career, that career is going to suffer. We need to start having education in terms of what viable trades are. And that will allow somebody to be inspired enough as a high school kid who's thinking about college, as a college person who's now learning a little bit more than that one semester that they take in architecture school of lighting, which now all of a sudden has to do with HVAC. You know, I think that's the thing that we need to, I'm hoping in the next few years starts to improve.
Thank you. Thank you to all of you for your leadership in your community, for your leadership in this industry. and for taking the time to share what you think about it all with me today. I think it goes without saying you're ridiculously passionate. You're also extremely accomplished in what you do. And I want to congratulate you on sticking to your guts, because you have. You're here because you want to be, and you're here because you make it happen. I wish you all the best this year, and I hope to see you soon.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thanks for asking us to participate.
Let's party.
Yes.
Awesome. Let's do it. Thanks, Sam.
Yeah.
Thank you. Thank you, guys.
Yeah.
Thank you. Good to see you guys.